Hello and welcome to the History of Singapore, Episode 41, Lord Selkirk's Tea Party. In late June 1961, news broke that Singapore Prime Minister Lee Kuan Yew had been secretly negotiating the reunification of Singapore with the Federation of Malaya. His actions and the actions of the British officials in Southeast Asia brought the PAP leaders' rhetoric over the past month into a new light. The revelation made reunification seem like it was a done deal to be imposed on Singapore, turning Singapore into a quasi-colony of Kuala Lumpur and possibly leading to the imprisonment without trial of Singapore's left wing. It was a great betrayal of the people of Singapore. And coming on top of 2 years in which Lee and his cabinet had acted with great arrogance, secrecy, and contempt for their fellow PAP members, 2 years where Lee had not kept his electoral promises and departed from the platform on which he had been elected, 2 years in which the PAP's popularity had nosedived and they had lost two important by-elections, this was the final straw. The left wing of the PAP felt betrayed. They had worked so hard to get and keep Lee Kuan Yew in power. Lim Chin Siong, in particular, had expended a lot of political capital reassuring his fellow trade unionists and urging left-wing unity. But Lee Kuan Yew seemed to have a death wish. For British Commissioner Lord Selkirk, Lee's fatal flaw was his character. He was insecure, mentally fragile, obsessed with Lim Chin Siong to a dangerous degree. Lord Selkirk, too, had attempted to convince Lee to moderate his tone and to adopt a more open consultative style, only to be brushed off. On 15th July 1961, David Marshall triumphed at the Anson by-election. In his victory speech at Anson, Marshall called on Lee Kuan Yew to resign, saying, quote, "Resign, and may you, in your retirement, learn humility and humanity, so that in the years to come, your undoubted ability may unselfishly and honestly serve our people." Unquote. But Lee would not be dissuaded from his path. And so both the British officials and the leaders of the PAP left wing anticipated that Lee Kuan Yew and his colleagues would soon fall from power. They began making plans for that eventuality. Both sides met at Eden Hall on the 18th of July, 1961. Present was British Commissioner Lord Selkirk and his deputy, Philip Moore, along with James Puthucheary, Lim Chin Siong, Fong Swee Suan, and S. Woodhull. This meeting, which history now calls the Eden Hall Tea Party — Eden Hall was the residence of the British Commissioner — and the 2 weeks following would be pivotal in the history of Singapore. The timing of events is crucial, and most of all, how the events were recounted, represented, and reported are crucial. This is cutthroat politics at its most sophisticated. It's a tangled web of deceit. And to illustrate this, today I'm going to tell the story twice. Once before the break, and once after. They are exactly the same, and they are totally different. Listen carefully. At 4:30 p.m. on 18th July, the six men met at Eden Hall. We have only one first-hand account of the meeting from Lord Selkirk, who wrote a report. It begins this way, quote, "James Puthucheary telephoned Lord Selkirk at Phoenix Park at about noon that day," that's 18th July, "to ask whether he could come to see Lord Selkirk accompanied by two of his friends," unquote. The report continues later, quote, "Puthucheary explained that his motive in coming to see Lord Selkirk was to seek a reassurance that in the event of the fall of Lee Kuan Yew's government, the British would not take over in Singapore," unquote. So basically, James Puthucheary and his colleagues wanted to know what would happen if Lee Kuan Yew's government fell. Would the British permit the normal constitutional process to continue and allow a left-wing government to come to power? Or would they suspend the constitution and reassert direct rule? Selkirk replied, quote, "His duty as United Kingdom Commissioner was to see the constitution of Singapore observed. Provided there was no infringement of the constitution or resort to direct action and violence, it would be quite improper for him to interfere in the political life of Singapore. However, if anybody broke the constitution or incited people in Singapore to industrial unrest and violence, he would not hesitate to take whatever action he considered necessary. Unquote. Remember this report. We'll come back to it in the second half. On learning of this meeting, Lee was driven to great desperation. Both his left-wing allies and his British colonial allies seemed to be abandoning him. You see, even before the meeting, he had already been seeking more and more desperate measures. Before the Anson by-election, Lee had cast around for leverage against his political opponents. He pleaded with the British to impose a timetable on reunification, also known as merger, which he could use to outflank his political opponents. No dice. He threatened to call a general election, which would lead to a more left-wing government taking power. But the British called his bluff and ignored him. He proposed he announce the release of all remaining political detainees, and the Internal Security Council countermanded. But Philip Moore refused, declaring, quote, Lee had lived a lie about the detainees for far too long, and it would be wrong for us to be party to this device for deliberate misrepresentation, unquote. Lee bitterly called the British selfish and declared his imminent fall from power. But Moore pointed out he still had an overwhelming majority in the Legislative Assembly, so what on earth was he so worried about? The night after the PAP's devastating loss in the Anson by-election, Lee and Goh Keng Swee dined with Lord Selkirk and Philip Moore, who found them, quote, pretty broken men, extremely jumpy and uncertain of their political future, unquote. In his desperation, Lee came up with a new proposal. He would table in the Assembly the Internal Security Council paper from August 1959, in which he had proposed the release of the political detainees. This would be proof that he tried to have the detainees released. As long-time listeners of this podcast would remember, Lee had then, in the next meeting, asked the Internal Security Council to veto his own paper. Lee would, after tabling this paper, would then suspend the Assembly to avoid further questions. This would conceal the fact that he had asked the Internal Security Council meeting to veto the paper so that his government would not, quote, soil their hands, unquote. If the British then gave an undertaking within the next 3 months on merger, he could then quickly hold and win the referendum on the issue. This, Lee argued, would then force the opposition into the streets, providing the perfect pretext on which to arrest them all. Selkirk called this plan, quote, unsavory and objectionable, unquote, and stating the British, quote, could not be party to a further lie, unquote. He reported to his boss in London, Secretary of State for the Colonies, Ian MacLeod, that, quote, Lee is not himself prepared ultimately to face the music, but was asking for the British and Federation to take the public odium, unquote. Selkirk was particularly upset because one of the paramount principles of the Internal Security Council was confidentiality. Indeed, his first act as Internal Security Council chairman had been to stress the paramount importance of keeping confidentiality. Lee had been using the confidentiality to his advantage by publicly declaring that the Internal Security Council was blocking the release of detainees while privately urging their continued detention. Now he was proposing to break confidentiality for his own political gain. Similarly, Federation Prime Minister Tunku Abdul Rahman was highly offended by Lee's deceit, and even more so by Lee's eagerness for the Federation to take responsibility for Lee's actions. He derided Lee as, quote, spineless, and declared that if Lee would not stick to the rules, then the Federation would withdraw from the Internal Security Council. The Tunku declared, quote, I can never trust that man again, unquote. And so, on 19th July 1961, Special Branch informed Lee Kuan Yew of the Eden Hall Tea Party. Lee grabbed this news and spun it for all it was worth. he went public with news of the meeting, accusing Lim Chin Siong and company of secretly plotting with the British imperialists. And despite the fact that Selkirk and the Tungku, the two men that Lee needed to keep happy in order to save merger, despite the fact that both of them had told him expressly not to make the Internal Security Council paper from August 1959 public, Lee made the paper public. It was his trump card. Now, you'll remember that before the Edenhall Tea Party, Lee had called for an extraordinary meeting of the Legislative Assembly for 20th of July, where he tabled a motion of confidence in his government. The Assembly met at 2:30 p.m. on 20th July. The right-wing leadership accused the left-wing of undermining their government. They declared that anyone who disagreed with them was against merger, as if one had anything to do with the other. Lee Kuan Yew attacked Lim Chin Siong and his colleagues as reneging on the pledge they had made before release from detention in 1959. The PAP left, in their reply, pointed out that it was Lee who failed to keep election promises and reminded him that the central struggle was against anti-colonialism, not merger. Lee was perpetuating colonialism, first by keeping the detainees in, then by seeking a warped form of merger which would cement Singapore's quasi-colonial status. When Lee Siew Choh reminded Lee of his pledge to free all political detainees, Toh Chin Chai responded by tabling the August 1959 Internal Security Council paper. Toh implied that it was the British and the Federation who had blocked further releases of detainees, and as such, releasing the detainees would jeopardize merger. He did not mention that it was Lee Kuan Yew who had asked the council to veto his own paper. Lord Selkirk was furious, livid, but with London's concurrence, he stayed silent. Lee's actions also caused great anger among British officials in Malaya, with High Commissioner Geoffrey Tory referring to the PAP leaders as, quote, highly educated but completely unscrupulous thugs, unquote. It also sent the normally genial Tungku into a massive fury. The Tungku angrily told the British that, quote, Lee was making unscrupulous use of us in order to save his own political skin, unquote. This had strengthened his conviction that Lee was not to be trusted. Get rid of that fellow, said the Tungku, and then we can get on with it. The motion of confidence passed. It wasn't even close. 27 votes for, 8 against, and 16 abstentions. Lee's autobiography makes it seem like a huge titanic struggle with all the assemblymen present, with constant negotiating and pleading and plotting, with Madame Sahora, the assemblywoman for Siglap, carried from her sickbed to walk the last few steps into the assembly chamber just moments before the door closed for division. But actually, the dissenting PAP assemblymen remained loyal to the end and refused to vote against the government. They had been lied to, insulted, abused, treated with contempt, and yet they still would not vote against the party leadership. So they abstained. The 13 PAP assemblymen who abstained were expelled, and this action finally precipitated a split between left and right. Around two-thirds of the party membership, including 19 of 23 organizing secretaries, resigned. On 23rd July, a press release signed by the dismissed members attacked Lee Kuan Yew for his internal party purge and ending all pretense of democracy. Quote, party members are obliged to be loyal to the objectives and principles of the party, not the individuals who are trying to monopolize power in the party, unquote. They predicted that Lee would eventually use the internal security laws against them, but urged the people to remain calm, reminding them that, quote, we have the constitutional means of removing ruthless men from office. The people can rest satisfied that they have the constitutional means of rejecting these wild men in power. Unquote. In August 1961, the expelled PAP members formed a new party, the Barisan Socialists, with Lim Chin Siong as Secretary General and Lee Siew Choh as Chairman. That's the story we know. But is it the entire story? When we return, I'll tell the story again. Stay tuned. Welcome back. George Nigel Douglas Hamilton, the 10th Earl of Selkirk, was a knight companion, a member of the Privy Council, a war hero, awarded the Air Force Cross and a Queen's Council. He was nobody's fool. A former First Lord of the Admiralty, he was British Commissioner in Singapore and British Commissioner General for Southeast Asia from 1959 to 1963. He was wily, inexperienced and diplomatic. He was appointed to Singapore in 1959 in place of William Good, whom the colonial office in London felt had become too close to the locals, too sympathetic to Lee Kuan Yew. Lord Selkirk was sent out because he was a safe, experienced pair of hands to whom the difficult and extremely critical situation of Singapore could be entrusted to. As British Commissioner, Lord Selkirk had few formal powers. It was his job to stay out of the spotlight, quietly advising the government, and to push them in the directions Britain wanted them to go, without them ever realizing, of course. Selkirk could not be seen to interfere. He could not be seen to be biased. He reported to London, but worked with a government responsible to the people of Singapore. And so, to achieve his aims, Selkirk had to use quiet influence, persuasion, and all the cunning of a fox who's just been appointed Professor of Cunning at Oxford University. And Selkirk's experience, his cunning, his political skill is demonstrated in the events of his Tea Party of 18th July 1961. You see, long before Anson, Lord Selkirk had become convinced that the PAP left needed to be split from the PAP right. Lee Kuan Yew was neglecting the governance of Singapore. Lee was obsessed with internal party politics. He was obsessed with defeating Lim Chin Siong and reasserting his authority within the party. Selkirk had concluded that the fundamental cause for all the problems in Singapore over the past year, from the PAP split in July 1960 when Ong Eng Guan was expelled, to July 1961 when the PAP lost Anson, was fundamentally due to Lee Kuan Yew's arrogance and his inability to take dissent within his own party. If the PAP left could be split from the PAP right, and they were in separate parties, Lee would be forced to turn his gaze away from his own party and return to governing Singapore in order to win the next election against a strong opposition. Lee needed a strong opposition in order to thrive because Lee was obsessed with power. If the contest came from within his own party, he would remain focused on internal party politics and neglect the country. But if it came from another party, he would focus on the Legislative Assembly to defeat them. And as an added benefit, engineering a PAP split would bring clarity to both sides. If the left ever made a mistake, they would be out in the open, away from the PAP, so it was clear who could be eliminated and who could stay. Lee would never move against members of his own party. If they made a mistake while part of his own party, he would be forced to defend them. But if the left were out of the party, and if they could then be provoked into making a fatal mistake, Lee would be happy to arrest them all. And in a worst-case scenario, if Lee had to resign and the left took power, well, maybe they would be better than Lee, and if they were worse, the British could always just get rid of them. But the problem was the PAP left were too loyal, too determined, too dedicated to the cause of anti-colonial unity to ever break from the PAP. Selkirk and his colleagues had been pushing Lee to break with the left, but Lee refused as he feared the consequences of losing the party base and losing his most popular politicians. So Selkirk had to engineer a split. He needed to quietly convince the PAP left that they could break away from Lee. He needed to tell them that the British would not stand in their way if they took power, and he needed to push Lee to getting rid of them. And so, he sent Woodhull a verbal message to call him. Not a paper message, which would have a permanent record. Not a telephone call, which would show up in the telephone logs. Those would show Selkirk acted first. No, he sent a verbal message via the journalist Francis Wong. This gave Selkirk plausible deniability. Once Woodhull received the message, he discussed the matter with his colleagues and it was agreed that James Puthucheary would telephone Selkirk's office to arrange a meeting. And when Puthucheary called, this then allowed Selkirk to claim that James telephoned him first, which was technically true. There was no document to claim otherwise. Now, remember, this is 1961. No mobile phones, no texting. Undoubtedly, the invitation took some time to arrive. And so sometime between the invitation, which we can assume was issued after Anson, either on the 16th or 17th July, and the phone call on the 18th of July, Lee Kuan Yew called for a sitting of the assembly to discuss a motion of confidence. This was not made public until 19th July, but it's almost certain that on 18th July, by the time the meeting occurred, Selkirk and Puthucheary already knew about the sitting. And also, in the meantime, the PAP leadership had dismissed Puthucheary as manager of the Industrial Promotion Board, as well as Lim Chin Siong, Fong Sui Suan and Woodhull as political secretaries. When Puthucheary called Selkirk on 18th July, he was naturally anxious and wanted to meet as soon as possible. Selkirk suggested lunch on 20th July, which would be the date of the sitting of the Legislative Assembly. But James insisted on meeting sooner, so they agreed to meet that afternoon, 18th July. Why did Selkirk suggest 20th of July? That was the day of the sitting of the Assembly. He knew Lee was planning to move against the PAP left. But what if the PAP left still refused to leave? What if Lee got cold feet? So perhaps a final push? With no time to reflect? Would that drive the PAP left to jump? Perhaps, on learning the news, the fragile and hot-tempered Lee would say something rash in the assembly, leading to the split? But James Puthucheary and his colleagues needed time to plan. They needed time to decide what their colleagues in the assembly should do. So James wanted to meet right away. And Selkirk agreed. Better to meet with them early rather than not meet with them at all. Remember the report Selkirk wrote? Let's take a look at it again, but more closely. It begins like this. Quote, James Puthucheary telephoned Lord Selkirk at Phoenix Park at about noon that day to ask whether he could come to see Lord Selkirk accompanied by two of his friends. Unquote. This is technically 100% correct, but contains no mention that Selkirk contacted them first. Indeed, the second paragraph of the report says, quote, Puthucheary explained that his motive in coming to see Lord Selkirk was to seek a reassurance that in the event of the fall of Lee Kuan Yew's government, the British would not take over in Singapore, unquote. Again, the impression is that the PAP left had taken the initiative to ask for the meeting. As you'll remember, Selkirk told them that as long as they played by the rules, as long as there was, quote, no infringement of the Constitution or resort to direct action and violence, unquote, he would not interfere. And this assurance would have far-reaching consequences. Because in the short term, it gave the PAP left confidence to take a firm stand against the PAP right, thereby helping to achieve the split that Selkirk so desired. But in the long run, Lim Chin Siong would insist that the left scrupulously adhere to the Constitution, scrupulously adhere to the law, and they would scrupulously adhere to peaceful methods of action. No matter how bad things got, Lim refused to sanction any violence or militancy. No matter how much the young militants in his party pleaded, shouted, demanded action, Lim would refuse. And so the British and Lee would never be able to find a legitimate excuse to arrest the left. And so eventually, and ironically, it would be the British and Lee Kuan Yew who would be forced to step outside the democratic process in order to rid themselves of the left. And I think a big part of the reason for that was because Selkirk sat down across from Lim Chin Siong and looked him in the eye and told him, as long as you follow the Constitution and use peaceful methods, I will not interfere. The meeting then carries on much as we expect. The report is a page and a half, so I won't read all of it here. You can see it for yourself. It's in public domain at the British National Archives. But what is very interesting is that at the bottom of his report, Selkirk adds the following very odd trivial note. Quote, in accordance with his usual practice of informing Lee Kuan Yew about visits made to him by political leaders in Singapore, Lord Selkirk then directed his staff to inform Special Branch and through them Lee Kuan Yew about the meeting. Selkirk notes that, in fact, it is doubtful whether they would ever otherwise have known that it had taken place, unquote. Why would Selkirk add this seemingly inconsequential note to the report? And also, at the bottom of the report is the date, 31st July 1961. The report was sent to London a full 2 weeks after the meeting. Why did he take so long to send the report? The answer to both questions is the same: because of what happened over the next 2 weeks. As mentioned, Lee Kuan Yew seized upon the meeting and claimed it was a conspiracy. The British had been manipulating the anti-colonial left to get them to rise up against Lee's leadership. Then either Lee would be forced to eliminate the left, thereby doing the dirty work of the British for them, or he would fall and the left would form the government, then allowing the British to arrest them. He told the public that he had suspected something was up, so he had spies watching Eden Hall, and that was how he found out. He publicly castigated the foolish Lord Selkirk for trying to manipulate him. But fortunately, Lee said, he had seen through the plan and he was not taken in. And yet, now, he said, he had to save Singapore by kicking out the left from the PAP. He would fight the left for the hearts and minds of the people. And that was what Selkirk wanted anyway. So Lee's defense was basically, I know Selkirk is manipulating me to do this, but I'm going to do it anyway, because I choose to do this, not because he placed me in a situation in which this is my only choice, because I choose to do this. And that was exactly how Selkirk wanted it. Lee was taking responsibility for his own actions, absolving the British of responsibility for what happened next. For Lee to say anything else would be an admission of weakness, of failure, or of a reliance on the British who had helped save him in a desperate time. A bigger man would have admitted his own weakness, but Lee had been maneuvered into a situation where he could not bring himself to admit it. And so in his autobiography, and to his dying day, Lee would insist that he already knew, that he was happy it happened, that he did it all of his own free will. Exactly as Lord Selkirk wanted. And so this explains why Selkirk added the seemingly inconsequential note to the end of his report and why he took 2 weeks. He waited for 2 weeks till 31st July to see how things had shaken out before sending his carefully worded report. In the intervening time, the only news that London would have had would have been the publicly available knowledge. But by including the final paragraph saying he instructed Special Branch to inform Lee Kuan Yew, otherwise Lee would have not known about the meeting, Selkirk was telling his boss, Ian MacLeod, what happened. With an eye to history, Selkirk had carefully drafted the report so that the truth of his manipulation would never be known. The report would show that Selkirk had behaved properly and not interfered, that the British hands were clean. Selkirk, the loyal soldier to the end, drafted a report that ensured that he would never get the credit for a brilliant political manoeuvre. But there was one other eyewitness. Dr. Po Soo-Kai spoke with James and Chin Seong when the message arrived with Woodhull. Dr. Po was part of the discussion about who would call Selkirk back and when. And if it weren't for Dr. Po's memoirs, we would never have known that Selkirk played Lee Kuan Yew like a cheap fiddle. It's no wonder that in his autobiography, Lee repeatedly went out his way to disparage and insult Lord Selkirk. In the course of recording this show, many people have asked me about how to understand historical sources, how to look beyond what is written down and analyze history. Well, often the most important revelations about history are not from what was written down, but from what was not written down, or even what was deliberately left out. And Lord Selkirk's Tea Party is a perfect example of that. The genius of Selkirk's intervention is not so much in ensuring that the PAP right and PAP left would break with each other. The PAP split would probably eventually have happened anyway. It was long overdue, Both sides were reluctant to let go, scared of the consequences, holding on in the hope that the other side would somehow suddenly change their minds, wanting to give it just a bit more time, just one more chance. Selkirk's push finally made it happen. But that was not his genius. No, Selkirk's genius was to make it happen and get someone else to come out and take full responsibility for it. Selkirk's genius was to conceal his role from the eyes of history. Fortunately for us, someone else happened to be there and has helped lift the curtains on an extraordinary series of events and on an extraordinary man. Next week, the battle lines are drawn. On one side, the PAP rump. On the other side, the Barisan Socialists. Join us then. As always, if you have any questions, comments or feedback, please email me at thehistoryofsingapore@gmail.com or visit my webpage at thehistoryofsingapore.com. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit Patreon, patreon.com/pjthumb. Thank you very much and see you next week.